Picking a Jury by Video, a tool to check your home's flood risk, and a book about Miami's future with sea level rise. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Courts, like other government agencies, have had to move a lot of their operations to the internet. We'll talk with a local judge about the challenges of keeping lawyers and juries socially distanced and how to run a trial online. Also, flooding is one of the prices we pay for living in paradise, but many of our flood maps are outdated. A new tool allows you to see exactly how much flood risk you face in your community. Finally,
if we don't manage to do it, I'm not going to get to celebrate my 80th birthday here because this is going to be probably worse than a subtropical Detroit.
We know the ocean is rising, but are we doing enough to protect ourselves from it? Sun Sentinel reporter Mario Ariza's new book explores the region's fight against sea level rise and a vision of what's to come. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. You may be one of the millions of people who have been working remotely since the start of this global pandemic. Our schools, our businesses, and our courtrooms have been forced to adapt. Judges, lawyers, and court clerks are navigating this field just like the rest of us. Recently, the first jury was picked by video in Miami-Dade, and the county is one of a handful in the state trying out a new video system. Well, as the state's eviction moratorium is set to expire at the end of this week, courts could be facing a deluge of new eviction cases, not to mention all the lawsuits that have been filed by businesses and municipalities that have been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. Joining us now to discuss this and more is Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Nushin Safi. Judge Safi, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
How have you adapted to running a court in a world of social distancing and masks and video meetings?
Personally, there were a lot of sleepless nights at the beginning trying to convert us over sort of to this new normal. But I would say as a system, we've adapted actually really well. And I would also say that my expectations were definitely surpassed. I think part of it's just technology being what it is. It's user-friendly technology, but we all came together really well, all the justice partners, and we pretty quickly put into place infrastructure that enables us to do as much work as possible without people actually physically coming to the courthouse.
When the pandemic arrived and we started closing things down, what was the process of closing down the courts? Because, I mean, you had a lot of people that are obviously in line waiting for their hearing, and that's going to determine, you know, what happens to them. But what was going on at the beginning?
So I still remember March 9th being the day where we started really preparing for what we knew was coming in terms of a shutdown. The criminal division cannot really shut down. We never shut down. Unless there's a hurricane, you know, on top of Miami, that's really the only circumstance that I can think of where the court system, the criminal court system, completely shuts down. We have people getting arrested, and they're entitled to have hearings within 24 hours. And barring something like an actual hurricane, we have those hearings set every single day. The good news is because we have those hearings every day and it's already set up as a closed-circuit system, we were able to sort of piggyback onto that system for a lot of criminal, not just essential, but really critical matters involving people getting released. So knowing that COVID was coming, we sort of had that. I think that was really the first thing we did, was trying to make sure that we still would have an avenue for regular access. And that was actually even used by some of the judges in the civil division that had emergencies that, and they needed access to a record before we were sort of up in Zoom running. I would say maybe 3 weeks after the shutdown, 2 or 3 weeks after the shutdown began in Miami, which I believe the first day of the shutdown was March 23rd. Again, criminal was still in operation, but the other divisions were shut down for about 2 weeks. And in those 2 weeks is when we all sort of overnight became Zoom experts.
I think everybody had to become one very quickly. That's true.
Yeah.
You know, going back to April, I mean, that's when some inmates were being released because there was a concern that still remains that jails are an easy place for the virus to spread. But what's the process? What was the process of determining which inmates got to leave, and how do they finish their sentence?
So there's two different questions. One is inmates leaving when they finish their sentence, and the other is inmates who have pending cases being released. So I'll take the second one first. So heading into the pandemic, release, I will say this, in Miami, I think people being held appropriately has always been a priority. And I will give huge credit to our prosecutor, Kathy Rundle, our public defender, Carlos Martinez, all the other attorneys, and our Department of Corrections, our local Miami-Dade County Corrections, because everyone works together really well on a regular basis to make sure that we have access and that nobody is being held unjustly or inappropriately. So we already sort of have that culture. Heading into the pandemic, my judges predominantly were focusing on release issues. I would say from March 9th up until the time that the courts shut down, that's what they were dealing with almost nonstop in their courtrooms for those 2 weeks. We no longer had trials. We closed off all jury trials at that point, and the focus was really just to make sure that we could get people out as quickly as possible and as appropriately as possible. I would say that the factors we were using are the factors that we always use. We have to take into account public safety. We have to take into account the seriousness of the offense, the person's family ties, what sort of, prior history they have, what's their likelihood of coming back to court. You know, it's all the factors that we normally have to consider. I don't think there was anything beyond that, but there was obviously a heightened sense of knowing that the jail could be vulnerable. And as the weeks after that showed us, the jail was vulnerable.
Yeah, and we still hear that issue. And you've heard from lawyers who say they're concerned. What are you hearing in Dade County about, again, efforts to protect inmates and possibly, again, move them out of facilities to keep them protected? What's going on now?
So we have they have a critical care list, which if an inmate has any risk factors, they're put on this list. And the director of Corrections Health Services gets us this list every single week in a sort of alphabet. It's a big list, but it's given distributed to all my judges every week so that they have an idea when they get a motion if a person has any particular vulnerability. That's obviously going to be a factor that's considered now, and in addition to all other factors that I stated. Corrections, I can't speak specifically to all their protocols, but they have protocols in place. What people may not realize is that because the jail is a jail and prisons are prisons, they normally have quarantine units, even outside of COVID times. So the word quarantine, while it might be something, novel to the rest of us, to people who work in corrections, it's not. They routinely have to worry about, let's say, tuberculosis or a chickenpox outbreak, and So the good news for them is that they sort of had a little bit of infrastructure already in place for quarantining and isolating people who might have an infectious disease. Obviously, they had to take it to another level. I've been very impressed with what they've done. I mean, again, if you can imagine what they have to manage on the best of days, managing what they've had to manage during COVID is truly an impossible task, and I don't know how they've done it as well as they've done it.
We don't know how long the pandemic will last, but I wondered your thoughts on, do you think even after this is all over that it makes us rethink, how we handle inmates and who we put in behind bars?
Yes, I think so. Again, speaking highly of Miami-Dade and in light of, in the course of this pandemic, I've had the opportunity to serve on roundtables with judges from across the country. We have a lot of good things in place here already. While we always focus on our problems, it is interesting to note that we are sort of ahead of the curve when it comes to incarceration. So our jail population is down now, and it's been consistently down about 1,000 inmates since the pandemic began. But as we were heading into the pandemic, we were at, I think, a historical low in terms of our numbers. And that is largely based on having mental health courts, having more diversion, having civil citations, and being generally really proactive about making sure that the people who are incarcerated are people who are supposed to be incarcerated and who need to be incarcerated, and not there's no less restrictive form of restraint that could work. So I think we were already pretty good on that. What I've noticed now is that most of the people who are in jail right now most of them are people who have been out of custody and on a case and picked up a new case, people who legally for a host of legal reasons aren't are not entitled to bond. Yeah. But I do think overall, I think the whole country is going to be focusing on this issue. And to be fair, the country was focused on this issue. I'm sure you've seen across in New Jersey and California, bail reform is a big topic, and it's definitely something that's been at the forefront of our conversations in the justice system for the last few years, working on some major bail reform.
I wanted to ask you about this. This happened not too long ago. There was a civil suit that took place. And from what I read, this is the first time that the jury was chosen via Zoom. I did my jury duty a couple years ago, and I'm trying to think, how in the world would that actually work? How did it work?
So, and actually, I think they're going to do another one in late August, early September, and we had it streamed on YouTube, so I would encourage you to watch it because I think it actually went really, really well. So it was a civil suit, and it took a while, but they were able to get lawyers to agree. And what they did was they just did the entire jury selection process on Zoom. The jurors, the clerk's office reformatted the summons. So when the jury summons came, it gave information on contacting the clerk's office, and so they were given specific information over the phone of how to call in and the Zoom ID and so on and so forth. So the jury was selected, but the trial was actually done live. So yeah. Those jurors, I believe it was 8 of them that actually came to the courthouse. But you are correct, the entire jury selection process was done via Zoom.
Trials are still done live, but obviously the trick is now you have to keep people separated. Everybody's got to wear their masks. Is it possible? Some courtrooms, at least the one I was in, was very small. Is it possible to do? Does it add an extra challenge for you?
It adds a lot of challenges. So a couple things. The civil pilot project was definitely a success, but because you have to deal with all these new factors, bringing a volume of people into the courthouse is just not feasible right now. And normally we are in the criminal division and in the civil division, there's multiple trials going on at the same time in these courthouses. So all the effort that it took to get that one trial done was Herculean. And our concern, obviously, is how do we take that new model, if that's the new model we're going to have to deal with for the next, let's say, 6 months or more, and scale it to what we're used to. And that is really kind of the bigger challenge, because you're right, we have limitations on space, and you really need to have people spread out. You also have limitations on the entrances and exits of these buildings, so you have to have the jurors coming in a way that they're, again, spaced out and socially distant and feeling safe. And you have to manage the rest of the population of the courthouses. Right now, our courthouses are not really open to anyone from the public. So if and when jurors are going to be coming in with any regularity, at the beginning at least, they're going to be really the only members of the public coming in. But at some point, obviously, the courthouses are going to open up, and depending on where we're at with a vaccine, it's going to be there'll be a lot of moving parts to manage again. Elevators, by the way, in our buildings are very old. There aren't enough elevators. A lot of our counterparts in other parts of the country who've been able to pull off jury trials, in large part, they have an elevator that they can dedicate. So just something as simple as that, can really make things a little bit more efficient and a little bit easier.
I can attest to that, those elevators at the courthouse, that's for sure. Again, talking with Miami-Dade Circuit Judge Nushin Saifi, courts, again, continuing to operate, but in a pandemic, things change. And so social distancing, masks, and now video, is a big part of how we are operating in this world. And you can read more, by the way, about this on our website at WLRN.org. You just said something, Judge Saifi, that I'm curious about is, I mean, look, all of this is Herculean in some ways, which has to mean you got a backlog of cases. What's going on with the backlog? How bad is it now?
It's pretty bad. I can't speak to the specifics of what the civil division is going through. I can tell you in the criminal division, each of my regular division judges is up about 100 cases, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it is. And we're obviously, all the judges are sort of been in action, but really back in action full force, I would say, as of July 6th. All the courtrooms are open. When I say open, open via Zoom. Most of the judges are coming here to the building physically, but we're limited in who we can have in the courtroom. We are a paper-based system here in Miami still for the criminal division. Hopefully that's going to change soon, but we literally have paper files I'm sure some of the younger listeners out there don't even understand what I'm saying when I say paper files, but we have paper files that we have to look at. And so the judges are physically here, and they're dealing with their caseloads, and we're doing as many hearings that we can do without that can be done remotely. Anything that we can do remotely, that the parties agree to do remotely, we are doing, just to try to at least put a dent in the backlog of cases. And obviously, civil's able to do the same thing. They are a little bit, they're more electronic than we are, so they have more ability to do their hearings.
And you got that backlog, and here we are now. We've reached this point where Florida's eviction moratorium is about to end. So unless the governor expands it, you know, we're done. That's more issues. People are going to be finding themselves in court. Last week, we spoke with Sean Rowley. He's an attorney for Legal Services of Greater Miami. This is what his concern was that he raised about the due process for tenants facing eviction. This is what he said.
One of the fears I have is that courts may be so overburdened with cases that they're going to try to rush through them and in a way that could run roughshod over people's due process rights in terms of if they raise defenses and having their defenses heard.
Judge Safi, are there discussions about how courts are going to process this issue, evictions, if you have a flood of them? If you have a flood of anything, how to handle that?
So, I mean, I would say these are discussions that we're having pretty much every single day. We have so many different committees and task forces going on right now. I think most of the judges, especially the administrative judges, are constantly meeting with people to try to figure out what's the best way to make sure that we can get justice not just back on track, but and addressing the concerns of due process. I think that, for the most part, I think, you know, there's going to have to be, I guess, some level of patience. But I will say this, the one thing that Miami does really, really well, and again, this is now proven to me by my many conversations with colleagues across the country, we have a lot of judges and we help each other out. So in an event where, let's just say that all of a sudden there's a flood of evictions and these, there are not enough judges, there are other judges in other divisions that will step up and will help out. Right now, domestic violence has had, you know, a really big backlog, and those are cases that can't wait. So many of the judges, many of my judges here have volunteered to assist that division. So I think that we're constantly addressing these issues so that we can see, you know, every day is a new day and every day there's new information. But I would like to assure the public that the judges are here, they're ready to work, they're already working, and they're going to work together so to make sure that people can get their justice and their due process as quickly as possible.
Beyond bringing in other judges to help you, I mean, is there what other efforts are there to expedite these cases, to get through them?
I mean, right now, as much as we can, whatever can be done right now is being done right now. So I can't impress upon everyone enough how much we've been working here. I think there's some of us I don't think I've worked this many hours, this many days in a row. It's been constant, and that's because we're doing everything we can to set up systems so that everything can be handled remotely. So as to, number one, lessen the backlog, but also just to make sure that people don't have to wait. Having to wait to have your issue resolved. At the beginning, we were focusing just on critical missions and essential functions, and now we're really trying to expand to everything. Because, again, just because your issue may not be considered a critical function, obviously to that individual, those people, it's a big deal. And so for them to get access is important, and that's what we're doing. So my hope, honestly, is that there will not be as big a backlog as we're fearing because we're doing so much now to proactively sort of prepare for that day.
Well, this is interesting. So just I'll finish up with this. I mean, you said you've never worked this much before, and not to pile on, I mean, we're probably going to see a lot more litigation because of this pandemic coming. I mean, we have cities that want to sue the county now over allocations of the CARES Act. So you're going to have more litigation on top of the evictions, on top of all this. Just curious, what's being done to make sure, one, they're keeping you, the lawyers, the court clerks, everybody safe, but also make sure that you're not, like the doctors and nurses, that you're not overworked?
So thank you for saying that, because the one thing I've said, and not about myself, but about many of the people who work in the courthouses, are maintenance folks, are clerks, corrections officers, the people that support us in the courtroom, court reporters, these are all people who you don't think of when you think of essential workers, and they are essential workers, and most of them have been working since day one. I mean, there was no time off to regroup, and most of them had to handle, you know, whatever might be going on in their personal lives and their family lives and still come to work. And I'm forever grateful because I've really seen so much good and so much hard work. As far as keeping the environment safe, the county's, you know, done a good job of making sure that, you know, everything's being cleaned regularly. Everyone has masks.
Do you get tested regularly? Do you get tested regularly?
I actually have been tested 3 times because the first test was probably just because I was paranoid. The second test was because I had an exposure. I went to the dentist and the hygienist. Luckily, 24 hours later, they called me to tell my hygienist, who cleaned my teeth, had tested positive. And then the third time was because I was going to be traveling to visit my elderly parents. So I've already been tested 3 times, but we are not testing regularly as any part in the court system. I mean, I wish we could, and we could have a whole conversation about testing and how it could and should be better in the system. But we're not requiring people to get tested. We are getting our temperatures checked regularly. And honestly, the courthouses themselves, because we're operating so much off of Zoom, are, you know, pretty empty compared to what they normally are.
Yeah.
So without the public coming in, I think everyone's pretty safe. I mean, I think we're safer, honestly, in the courthouse than we probably are in our own homes to some extent. But so I can't say anything about safety. I think everyone here feels safe, as safe as any member of the public, you know, as safe as any constituent in Miami-Dade County can feel right now. But I think the courthouse itself is safe. But obviously it's safe because the members of the public are not coming in.
Well, Judge Safie, I know how busy you are, and so I really do appreciate the time and giving us the insight on what's going on inside the courtroom.
I want to add one more thing.
Sure.
I want to add also a little plug for the public libraries. The public library system, most of them, I think, I don't know about all of them, but we're working on gathering a list and working with the public libraries to have computers and, like, Zoom kiosks so that members of the public who need to access the court system or access Zoom or otherwise for whatever their needs might be are going to have access to Zoom kiosks at the public libraries.
I want to thank my guest, Miami-Dade Circuit Court Judge Nushin Safie. Judge Safie, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Take care.
All right. Well, still to come, it's hurricane season. Do you know the flood risk in your neighborhood? We're going to learn about a new tool to see if your home is at risk. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It's already been an incredibly busy hurricane season in the Atlantic, with forecasters monitoring a tropical cyclone that's expected to become Tropical Storm Isaias. If it forms, it's going to be the ninth named storm of the season. Forecasters from NOAA say Florida could see the impacts of the storm by Sunday, but we're going to keep you updated as it progresses. Now, homes throughout South Florida face high risk of flooding from these storms. Do you know what risk your community faces? Well, there's a new tool called Flood Factor to determine your home's flood risk, and it'll help you decide if you need flood insurance and how much you should be paying. Joining me now is Melissa Roberts, founder and president of the American Flood Coalition. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
You know, as we monitor this tropical disturbance, I'm wondering, what concerns do you have about South Florida's ability to respond to storm surge and the flooding right now, and then add to the fact that we're dealing with a pandemic on top of all that?
Yeah, for communities across the country, I've been really worried that hurricanes in the pandemic environment really do create a dual disaster scenario where COVID makes it more difficult to do the response you need for the hurricane when you think about evacuating and sheltering people and you think about getting out good communications. And on the other hand, doing all that could possibly make the public health response more difficult. So that's the number one concern I have. And I think for local leaders and community residents who are already struggling in this really difficult environment, it puts a huge burden on the sort of response we're going to need to see.
You've been coordinating with cities across South Florida on their resilience strategies for flooding, but what are they telling you about their greatest needs right now?
I think the biggest challenge across the board is the fact that communities are facing budget cuts, and this is a really unprecedented environment. And this is coming at a moment where a lot of communities in South Florida were poised and needed to make big investments in adaptation to protect against what we're seeing now, which is when the next storm comes, increasing tidal flooding, increasing heavy rainfall. And it's really difficult to make that investment when budgets are being slashed and positions are being furloughed or cut.
And you talk about that, and interestingly enough, the city of Miami had a resilience office, and they're taking that and the public works office and combining the two. What's wrong with doing that?
I think what we're really seeing is these difficult decisions that are having to be made in communities in Florida and across the country when these difficult choices are being made with limited dollars. And what we really need to see is the federal government step up and give these communities a lifeline so that they can invest.
Looking at the sort of infrastructure that the American Flood Coalition proposes, some of it looks a bit expensive. But then, I mean, this is going to be expensive, but can it be done cheaper?
Yeah, I think, I mean, investment is required, and we know that it pays off. We know that spending $1 before a disaster strikes saves $4 to $7 on the back end, but we also know there's a lot of ways that this is getting cheaper. And a lot of it, we say new technology, but a lot of it is thinking about actually older forms of technology. So thinking about nature-based solutions like dunes, mangroves, and other ways to absorb water and tidal surge as they're coming in that can protect people. And I think we're really seeing a newfound appreciation for those sorts of solutions that have actually existed for a really long time.
Do we know which one is better? Is it like you look at Miami Beach, for example, they have this very big, expensive pumping system. They're trying to raise roads in many places. Is that going to be more successful doing that and building walls or creating more natural settings?
Yeah, it's usually not an either or. It's often that you need some solutions in some places and a mix of these sorts of solutions. So there are some places where a traditional wall is just needed. But in a lot of places, if you can integrate that with a living shoreline, the community is going to like it better. It's going to create additional benefits. And it's just going to work a lot better. And I think the biggest thing we need is to make it easier for the communities that want it to integrate these sort of nature-based solutions, which are right now really hard to permit and hard to get funding for and are at a disadvantage.
I'm talking with Melissa Roberts, founder and CEO of the American Flood Coalition. The coalition has partnered with the First Street Foundation and has a new tool called Flood Factor, where you can determine your home's flood risk. You could find it on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Melissa, you spent years traveling around South Florida and, you know, speaking with leaders, nonprofits, a lot of different people. But I'm wondering, from your travels, how much does the average person know about their flood risk in their community?
Very little. Most people have two main interactions with their flood risk. One is if they're buying a home, when they're going through the mortgage process, they're going to have, through their piles of disclosure, there's going to be something about whether they're required by the federal government to buy flood insurance, and that will probably be lost in the piles of paperwork they're signing. And then, you know, a lot of folks, especially in South Florida, their next experience might be when their property floods or their road floods, and it's, you know, an unwelcome and unexpected experience.
So I was looking at this and I typed in my address and I found that my residence is not just in a flood zone, it's in the middle of what looks like a lake. And so I was feeling a little bit down by that. But how is a person supposed to read that? When I see that, what is it telling me and what should I do next?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to come from this data is first that for the first time, the average person like you and I has access to the same data that for a long time only commercial real estate interests that could afford big cat models for multiple millions of dollars were able to look at. So we're all on the same playing field now, which is important. And then the second thing is to say, you know, there are going to be places at risk, but how do we make smart decisions? So thinking about having flood insurance if you're at risk, thinking about small things you can do around your property to reduce flooding. So for some folks, it might be flood vents, it might be having additional plants and drainage, but just knowing what's coming and being able to prepare is so important.
And I'm wondering too, what are the common mistakes people make when they purchase flood insurance? How much should I be paying for that?
Yeah. I mean, this one thing I hear a lot from people is how unaffordable flood insurance can be. And that's absolutely a problem we need to address at the federal level. But one really interesting thing is that a lot of people are actually overpaying for flood insurance. When they've gone in and done studies, they found that especially low and middle income homeowners are often overpaying. For instance, they might be paying for a policy that's going to cover a home up to $250,000 in replacement value when their home's worth less. And so they're overpaying. Another thing that a lot of people can do is if your home's raised up off the ground, if you submit an elevation certificate, that can often really lower your flood insurance. And the last most important thing is that if your city is part of the CRS program and does actions to be responsible, it can lower everyone's flood insurance cost.
You know, you said it earlier when you talk about what the communities are facing right now with the pandemic. What do you see as the biggest challenge moving forward? Is it going to be on the communities, the state, or do we have to depend on the federal government to help us with this?
I think it's a challenge at every level, and we do a lot of work at the local level because our communities are going to need to drive and envision what the solutions look like and not just be told by the federal government or the Army Corps what their neighborhoods are going to look like into the future. But knowing the challenges ahead, our communities, what we hear across the board every day in every conversation is that our communities need support from the state and federal government. They need funding, they need more flexibility, they need less hoops to jump through in permitting and paperwork so that they can serve their constituents and keep them safe.
And that is a big thing right now, just trying to keep us safe. But we've got this pandemic, and now we've always had this issue with flooding that's always been there as well. Melissa Roberts, founder and executive director of the American Flood Coalition. Again, they partnered with the First Street Foundation. They have this tool. It's called Flood Factor, where you can determine your home's flood risk. Check it out. It's on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Melissa, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, talking about flooding. With sea level rise, what will the city of Miami, and South Florida for that matter, look like in the decades to come? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I want you to imagine the year is 2067, and you're sitting in an apartment along Miami's shoreline. You're staring at the water from your elevated street, and you're watching as a system of pumps and drains and natural habitat keeps the sea level at a safe distance. For Sun Sentinel reporter and author Mario Riza, this would be the ideal way to spend his 80th birthday alongside friends and family. But this future is by no means guaranteed. Mario's new book is called Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe. And it examines the threat of sea level rise and climate change to the city's economy, housing, health, and landscape. Sundial senior producer Chris Remington spoke with Mario about his lifelong connection to the Magic City and the precarious future that it faces.
Can you remember the first time as a kid or as a young adult where you felt the vulnerability of this city just a few feet above sea level? Can you think to a particular moment in time where it really struck you?
As a kid, I had no idea that this was going on. There was a canal at the end of my street, and there were some weird orange fish in the canal that I could never catch with my fishing pole. And I didn't know why that canal was there or that it was connected to a giant drainage system, which kept my house from turning into the swampland that it was less than 100 years ago. And you know, the kind of closest that we ever came to it in my family's oral histories were, you know, our stories about hurricanes. Whenever there was a close call, I remember my grandmother would tell stories about how her dad in Santo Domingo after the great hurricane of Saint Xenon in 1932, spent weeks and weeks with his platoon of soldiers and handcart picking up the dead out of the rubble in Santo Domingo. And my mother would tell stories of, like, you know, the giant trees that fell down in Hurricane David in the 1980s. And then my uncles and my cousins who'd been here for Andrew would tell their stories. So there was always the cognizance of, like, oh, wow, if a big hurricane hits, things are going to be rough. But, you know, there wasn't an understanding of how rising water and increasing heat and stronger storms because of human activity and human industrial activity were going to make things that much worse.
So yeah, you had mentioned that you came back to Miami. You're originally from the Dominican Republic, but you've traveled all over. I know you Vermont to China to New York City. So I just got to ask, what keeps bringing you back here? Why do you keep coming back to Miami?
I wish there was, like, one thing that I could put my finger on about, like, what I really love about this city. I can tell you what was different when I came back here in 2015. I found that there was an arts community. I found that there were people engaged in cultural production, and that there was, you know, an intellectually vibrant space to kind of ask questions and meet interesting people who were making art or making music or making cool food. So that's definitely one aspect. Another aspect is, you know, my family. It's really nice to be able to, well, it was really nice to be able to go to hang out with grandma before the plague broke out. Having your people close by to you is important.
And you mentioned your parents, and I think this is a fascinating part of the book. They actually work in high-end Miami real estate. So I'm wondering, what did they say to you when you told them you're writing this book about the forces that are going to threaten their livelihood?
Oh, man. At first, they were a little worried. You know, they're like, what is this going to do to our business? But you know what? To their credit, they have striven to understand as much about the issue and how it affects their market mightily. Like, they really do care about this now, and they really do understand what's going on as best they can. And really, I think their hunger for knowledge about this stuff is actually pretty common in realtor circles, right? It's, you know, on one end, maybe folks don't want to talk about what's going to happen here. But on another end, like, they're really hungry for information about what climate change is going to do to specific properties and how it might affect property values. I think as more folks realize what's going to happen here, they're going to be acting like my parents, and they're going to get really hungry for that kind of data.
Yeah, and it's not just your parents and sort of brokering the deals. It's also investors. One of my favorite stories is your chat with, you call him the Count, this Argentinian investor who had a lot to say about your tattoos and personal life choices. But more importantly, he gave you this interesting insight that we don't necessarily see about how investors are thinking about the vulnerability of properties. Can you tell us a little bit about his story and sort of what he explained to you?
So the Count was a fascinating individual, and he was trying to offload some properties in Miami at the time. I understand that he looked at his properties in Miami as investments. Right? They were places to store value. They weren't places to live in. They were places to either generate rent from, or perhaps, you know, buy with one currency and sell in another currency and generate or offset or hedge other risky investments that he would make with his money. And in that sense, he's very much like a lot of the real estate buyers that end up purchasing a lot of the condos and a lot of the high-end real estate here in the city. Because if you're like most 30-somethings here in Miami, you're not necessarily in the market for $1 million or $2 million or $3 million house or condo. Maybe if you're lucky, you're looking for a starter home, or you're looking for an affordable place for rent. And the reason why there aren't starter homes and affordable places for rent much of the time is because a lot of the market's activity is pointed at these folks looking for $2 to $3 to $4 million homes. And the fact that the people who own those homes don't live here means that they are not necessarily as concerned as you or I, the renter or the person who's buying a starter home, are when it comes to issues about climate change, right? Their apartment is sitting empty in Brickell while they're in, I don't know, Moscow or St. Petersburg or Ghana. And the way I got a title for this book was actually from a conversation with the lobbyists for the developers. I was like, well, what do you think about climate change here? And he had told me, well, I just hope the city has 5 or 6 more business cycles left. that's when I felt like my city was being treated disposably. And it's connected intimately with this flow of foreign capital that at once powers the economy, lets the city afford services, lets us pay for, you know, picking up the trash and all other kinds of government services. But at the same time, it essentially creates an urban landscape that doesn't serve the people who live here.
So one of the things I love about the book, Mario, is you go on these different expeditions or adventures, and it helps us see the city in a different way. And one of them was this kayaking trip that you went on with a filmmaker. And I'm wondering first, like, just going out on the water, seeing Turkey Point and Virginia Key and the city skyline, how did it help you better understand how much the city is connected to water, like how much it's a part of our identity when you're seeing it that way?
I feel like in some ways Miami's identity is all about the saltwater here, right? The ocean, the beaches, the boating, the cruises, right? Everybody wants to be there. Nobody wants to consider the freshwater environment here. We live with our backs towards the drainage system that was once the Everglades that we now inhabit. We don't use it very much. We don't think about it very often. As long as it works, we don't care about it. But the fact is, you can get to almost anywhere in Miami on a kayak without touching land. You can literally get from the airport to Coconut Grove or Coral Gables without ever using a car. So that identity that we don't acknowledge is ultimately also one of the identities that is going to be very, very troublesome for us, because in the same way that people don't think about it, it's a very complicated system that is losing capacity because of sea level rise. This is the drainage system, the South Florida Water Management District. And at the same time, it's a drainage system that has had its budget cut for almost 10 years now. The Scott administration really did do a number on it.
I'm speaking with Sun Sentinel reporter and author Mario Ariza. His new book, Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe, is available now. You can find more details in our social media at WLRN Sundial. You had mentioned it earlier, the Florida Everglades. This was another expedition that you went on. And it's so interesting because the River of Grass, it's an hour west of Miami. It's so different from life in Miami, yet it's so intertwined to the quality of our water and to our health and livelihood.
I knew I really wanted to write a chapter about the Everglades, and the best way to start about writing a chapter about the Everglades was to go python hunting. It was difficult to understand just how quiet and still and just what an effect the pythons had been having in the Everglades until I went out there, because I remember going out as a kid and seeing lots of little animals. I went out to an area by Broward County called Water Management 3A, and there was just like nothing there. And when you ask the people and you look at the studies, it's just the pythons have eaten everything. And you're like, okay, that's kind of awful. But the pythons are the most charismatic face of all of the rest of the awfulness that we have done to the Everglades. The main issue with the Everglades is that it was a beautiful natural system that kept the Miccosukee, who are descendants, and the Seminole, who are descendants of the Cherokee Creek Nations, from being wiped out and moved over to Oklahoma, right? Like, this is how difficult this terrain was. They fought three wars against the United States, and they were successful in maintaining themselves in this environment. We replaced that natural system beginning in the turn of the century with the drainage projects and in the 1940s with a political system. Right? And you're like, no, wait, we replaced it with a mechanical engineering hydraulic system. We move the water, we drain it. Yeah, but who manages that mechanical system? It's the South Florida Water Management District and its board of directors, which is appointed by the governor.
One thing that you mentioned briefly there, but I want to talk a little bit more, is about the role of the Miccosukee tribe in protecting the Everglades. And you spoke with the leader there, Michael Frank, and he's been key to this fight to save the Everglade for decades. And I'm wondering, considering how long this fight has been going and these changes in administration, how optimistic Frank is that Everglades restoration is actually going to come to fruition.
They're fighting this fight because it's their home. And we have to fight the fight too, because it is our home as well. There have been people who have been fighting on behalf of the environment here for generations. But what I hope changes this time around, and the intervention I really hope to make with this book, is the realization that the environment and the economy and your pocketbook, they're all interconnected, right? Because if you can stay home and not put as much greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and if we can change this and turn this, you know, extrusion around, maybe we can save the city.
The book outlines all of the characters that play a role in the future of the city. You've talked to climate activists, politicians, real estate developers, journalists like yourself. In your estimation, do you see the developers as the one drawing the future for our city? Who do you see as holding really the key to solving these big problems?
I think we definitely have a political system in this city that is designed to provide outcomes for specific business sectors, right? And they are the business sectors that drive the economy. So in a certain sense, it's very rational, right? If the tourism sector needs something, it's easy for them to get it. If the development sector needs something, it's easy for them to get it. And I feel like one of the reasons why there has been a lot of progress at the municipal level is because the tourism sector and the certain parts of the development sector realize that we're all in this together and that adaptation needs to happen. But I don't necessarily think that folks have put two and two together when it comes to climate change and inequality, and how if you're going to solve for climate in Miami, you have to solve for inequality.
I'm glad you brought up the issue of social inequality, because I think one of the really important characters that you speak with in your book and someone that we've had on the show is Valencia Gunder. And she's someone who understands really firsthand the issue of climate change gentrification as she's watching her neighborhood of Little Haiti start to bring in more high-end development. Can you just give our audience a little bit of who Valencia is and what she's seen over the past couple years that illustrates that problem?
Valencia is a force, man. She broke it down for me when I first met her, the way that heat was connected to gentrification on the high ground in Miami in a way that I had never heard. It was a really hot day when I met her, and she just kind of said, look, listen, it's really hot, and there's a lot of people in Liberty City and in the neighborhoods that she is familiar with who can't afford to run their air conditioners all the time, right? And so because of that, the older ones, the ones who have COPD and asthma, right, who are more likely in these communities to actually own their homes, are also much more likely to sell them. And that is a vulnerability. But the book delves into a legal battle against a major development, the Magic City Innovation District. And, you know, like, okay, fine, what does the Magic City Innovation District have to do with climate change? Well, the developers for the Magic City Innovation District literally have on their marketing material saying, we're building a resilient development on the high ground. Okay, who does that high ground belong to? That's a section of town that what it is today is the product and effort of, you know, Haitian American immigration, and their displacement onto the lower ground, probably, because I think that's where we understand that they're going, makes everybody more vulnerable.
Yeah, because you talk about early in the book your experience celebrating your abuela's 80th birthday party and how you want to have that same experience celebrating your 80th birthday here. Coming back to what I asked you initially, why do you want to, you know, spend so much of your life here? Why do you want to live here till you're 80?
You know, we've got family in on the island still, and family here, and folks in Connecticut, and, you know, just people kind of everywhere, and they all came together for the birthday party. I was kind of a wallflower at that party. I had been doing a lot of research in the book. We held the party at the top of this condominium in Brickell, and you could kind of see the whole city from there, and I couldn't help but thinking that, you know, this city, if it survived, was going to change. And even if it didn't survive, it was really going to change. And thinking about the death of your city and whether or not you will be able to have a similar party when you turn 80, if I turn 80, and if I'll be able to sort of like gather the people that I care about in my life in such a matter in the city that I care about, kind of really bummed me out, man. Because it was a tough question to answer, right? Like, if we do it right in 2067, when I turn 80, Miami may very well be a place that has adapted to 1 to 2 feet of extra sea level or 3 feet of extra sea level, and we'll have solved a lot of the problems that we need to solve to get there, and it'll have been difficult, but we will have come together as a community to have done it. But if we don't manage to do it, right, I'm not going to get to celebrate my 80th birthday here, because this is going to be, you know, probably worse than a subtropical Detroit.
That was Sun Sentinel reporter and author Mario Ariza. His book is called Disposable City, Miami's Future on the Shores of Climate Catastrophe. It's available now. You can find more information on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And that's Sundial for this Wednesday, July 29th. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a year-long WLRN investigation into the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. It found defendants were encouraged to donate significant funds to charities to reduce their criminal sentences. WLRN reporter Danny Rivera will explain how those charities are connected to State Attorney Catherine Fernandez Rundle and the impact that it should have in a heated state attorney race. Plus, the University of Miami, along with a number of private universities across South Florida, are set to begin in-person classes in the coming weeks. We're going to hear from a UM professor about concerns teachers and faculty have with the spread of the virus in classrooms and across campus. And finally, we're already seeing how the pandemic is impacting professional sports. 15 players on the Miami Marlins have tested positive for COVID. The future for high school sports is unclear. Parents, if you have a kid who's playing high school sports, are you going to let them? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Thanks again for listening. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.